Hey, all right, friends, welcome back to the podcast. I'm Joanne, and this is her story. I'm excited for this episode. I'm always excited about the episodes. But Dr. Brent Neely is joining me in this episode, and we talk about ancient prayers. And this is still in the deconstruction series that I'm doing. So he talks about his own wrestling with his faith and the church and some other things, and in the process, discovering the ancient forms of worship and disciplines that really kind of helped ground him into the deeper roots of our faith and following Christ and the way. And so I think some of these things for those who are beginning the process of deconstruction, or maybe you just trying to understand more about what it means to deconstruct your faith. I think that this episode will really be helpful. This is kind of like a practical, tangible, how do I walk through that, through this process of deconstructing my faith without actually ending up losing it altogether? And so I think you'll be encouraged about that. Just a couple other updates I wanted to bring to you, and that is you're probably going to see a whole bunch of episodes come out at once over the next few weeks, and then you probably won't hear from me at all in November and December because I work for the Salvation Army and Red Kettle season is kicking off, and Salvation Army raises probably 75% of their annual budget between Giving Tuesday and the New Year. So we're going to be busy, busy, busy. Plus, I'm finishing up my grad work. I just started my grad work, which somebody asked me about that in after listening to one of their most recent episodes. And I started my master's at Michigan State Theological Seminary, Michigan State University, and they have a brand new program. I'm one of the first cohorts to go through this group. It's nonprofit leadership, global cultures, and social enterprise, and with the idea of really want to move into some advocacy work and nonprofit work, where I feel like I can do a better job at sharing the love of Jesus with the world, and so working on that degree, and we'll see what God's going to do with it. So I'm excited, maybe for the first time in a long time in ministry, about the possibilities. So I'll keep you apprised to that, and let you know. Anyway, that's kind of my life update. So, welcome again to the podcast and enjoy episode 116. We've been trying to tell better stories about women and clergy and the church because we really need to tell better stories. Instead of just complaining about it, what if we flood the airwaves with something different? Well, welcome to the podcast, Brent.
Hey, thank you for having me.
I'm glad that you could be here. I think we have a lot. I think we have several friends. Even we've never met in person, but we have several friends in common. So I feel like in some ways I know you. I started this series on deconstruction, and I've been interested in some of the stuff that you're doing where you're at now. And so that's why I wanted to have you on the podcast to kind of talk about how all of this has I don't know, I guess just helped you process stuff. But you're ser so right now you're serving as a hospice chaplain and then an associate pastor. So what does that look like? Like, what's your roles there in those two places?
So with my hospice job, like you said, I'm a hospice chaplain. We are either the largest or the second largest hospice in the Kansas City metro area. I actually just got an email from my boss today saying we've hit over 500 patients that we are actively serving. And before that, I was with a hospice that On a good day, we had 26. So quite a different setting where I feel like I'm often called in different ways, and just having to learn to be flexible. Anytime we look at hiring a new chaplain, I tend to be a part of those interviews, and I always ask, are you able to make a schedule and kind of schedule out what you need to do while also remaining flexible enough to know that you're going to get called at any given time to pray with somebody, to be with a family as they're grieving, to sit beside somebody as they're dying. And so a lot of what I do is making routine visits with patients and just making sure that they have somebody to support them. And I tell people all the time, essentially they pay me to hang out with people, which I absolutely love. And getting to know their families and walk with them through a difficult time. I think we're all familiar with death. We all know that it's going to happen. We all know that it's out there, but yet every time it happens, it's still a shock to the system. It's still world breaking. There's still that idea of, although we know this is happening, this still isn't right. Death is not a right thing. And so being able to journey besides with or journey beside families as they grieve, as they come to terms with what it means for their loved ones to die. And even depending on how with it the person is, being with them as they figure out what it means for them to have a good death. I've worked with people as old as 106 and as young as 31. And so just kind of being beside them as they ask those questions, as they name their fears, as they ne name their anxiety, as they name their hopes, and just being able to be beside them is such a cool thing. And with my local church, I'm a part of the Belton New Horizons Church of the Nazarene, and I'm lucky enough that I get to serve with an absolutely amazing staff, Pastor Jay Wilson, Pastor Angie Burr, Pastor Annie Neely, and myself. And it's such a cool team that we have put together with such a cool little church. I often tell people we're not a huge church. We're running maybe 35 to 40 on a given Sunday, but everybody's actively involved. Everybody's participating. Everybody's looking for ways to grow in fellowship and community and faith. And so it's really fun. We rotate preaching, we rotate teaching. 2 nights ago, I think it was now, we did a spiritual deepening night where we had one of the professors from Mid-America come and talk to us about the wisdom literature. And so it's a really fun place where our church has blessed us, where they've given us freedom to say, hey, let's figure out what it means to be faithful together. And so I've got it made. I've got two great jobs that I absolutely love. So
That's pretty cool. And I forgot that your wife was also a pastor. Now, chaplaincy, was that your original call? Like when you had your call to ministry, did you originally feel a sense calling into chaplaincy?
No, so I don't know the exact demographic of your podcast listeners, so I'll kind of change the language that I originally said. When I was in seminary, I took a chaplaincy class because Judy Schwanz was teaching it, and I just adored Judy, and I was like, I know this is a way people can serve and be faithful, so I'll take this class and learn about it. And I remember talking with her saying, I think at some point I should do a unit of CPE in a hospital because it scares the crap out of me. Just being in a hospital like that, being surrounded by people that are injured and dying and diseased and sick, things that we as Christians are probably supposed to do, but it just terrified me. And then I did nothing about it for several years. And then one of my buddies, while I was working at a psych hospital, was a chaplain for the University of Kansas Health System, and he asked me to apply to do a year-long residency, because he said he thought I'd be good at it. And I said, yeah, I've thought about it. Yeah, it was kind of one of those things where it was within a span of about 4 days, I went from having one job to having to start the chaplaincy job. and just absolute chaos. And I really enjoyed it. And as it was coming to an end, I wanted to continue in chaplaincy, knowing that I probably wouldn't be able to do a hospital chaplaincy just because of the requirements it takes and not being board certified yet. So I looked into to hospice chaplaincy again with the idea of I don't particularly like death. I still have a lot of questions about it. It's still, I'm not at peace necessarily with the idea of my own death and recognizing that one day I will die. And so for the last year, being confronted with that daily has been good for me to be able to see people die well and to help them die well. It gives me a lot of hope, even for my own death when that comes, which is very monastic in several ways. Saint Benedict tells us to keep death before our eyes daily, knowing that we're going to die. And so knowing that we're mortal, we need to live accordingly and do what we need to do with the time that we have. And so I originally was not planning on going into chaplaincy, but I found that it has been just such an opportunity to minister to people where they're at without necessarily the expectations that higher ups and one's denomination or church necessarily places on people. I just get to listen to people where they're at and meet them there and journey alongside them and just be a friend on the road as they travel through faith and life. And to me, I found it to be such a rewarding ministry. You know, whether it's one lady who I would go over to her house weekly, she was a very much lapsed Presbyterian. She didn't really have anything to do with the church anymore. But she loved it when I would come over every Thursday and we'd watch the Royals game or A League of Their Own on Amazon Prime or whatever she wanted to watch. And, you know, she was always, aren't you supposed to be preaching to me or something like that, Pastor? I'm like, only if you want me to. Otherwise, I'm here to hang out with you and just be with you and provide that space to be with you. And, you know, because part of what was going on with her that I don't think she could name out loud was that her family wasn't around. She was elderly and alone, and she suffered from loneliness. And so just having somebody that could come in every week and spend time with her was the highlight of her week. And to me, as a Christian, I can't think of anything more Christian than that.
Yeah. Loneliness is definitely a plague in our country and around the world. I mean, I know that ancient worship, liturgy, monasticism, however you want to phrase it, is become a very important part of your ministry. Mm-hmm. How did that kind of like come about? Like, I know that you've been a Nazarene all your life, and we are not very liturgical or monastic at all. Sure. So how did you get to that place?
I often tell people that I blame Jeremy Scott, who's a pastor out near the Boston area, for all of this. Sometimes I look back to my senior year of college and I wonder if he knew what he would create by taking me on as an intern and introducing me to a more liturgical form of worship. And so for me, how I got involved with it was through a number of pieces that all ended up clicking together. And I know for a lot of people, when they look at the liturgy or a high church model or the idea of monasticism, you know, these things that I'm really interested in and really ground myself in, they kind of look at it and think that might not make sense for a Nazarene. In my experience, I think it makes a whole lot of sense. You know, as Wesleyans, John Wesley was, you know, he was all about the works of piety and the works of mercy, and that we need to have these two go hand in hand, right belief and right action and right heart. That's very Benedictine as well for the Benedictine monks and nuns, ora et labora, prayer and work. They go hand in hand. Albert Outler, in a throwaway footnote in one of his papers, says that he thought the Church of the Nazarene should be a holiness order rather than a holiness denomination. And so there was little things like that, that as they started clicking together, it just made sense for who I believe we are to be willing and open to this sort of thing, as well as connecting to our Anglican roots. You know, we trace ourselves through the Methodists, who then trace themselves through John Wesley and the Anglicans. And so just kind of in ways reminding us who we are. But all that long story. So when I was in college, there came a point where I was just kind of done with the church. I had been hurt by a church pretty badly. And the pastor of that church, who he's no longer there, actually emailed me several weeks ago and apologized for some of the things that had happened during that time. And so I'm grateful for that. And but yeah, while I was there, there was a lot of hurt that took place, where people looked at me and who I was and essentially told me that I had to change in order to be able to serve there. You know, even little things such as, hey, your jeans had holes in them, and you can't be on the platform if your jeans have holes in them. Or I was serving communion with the other pastors one day, and one of the associate pastors came up and said, hey, I noticed you weren't wearing shoes up there. And I said, oh yeah, I've preached on this before. People have heard my story about believing that we're on holy ground when during a worship service. And so I take my shoes off just as a way for me to remember that I'm coming into the presence of something greater than myself. And he was like, well, that's cool. Don't do it again. I'm like, well, sorry. Like I won't do it again. Like I won't serve communion with you guys, because this seems like a really petty thing to make a big deal over. And there were other things, such as I was asked to go with one of the pastors to go to somebody's house that I didn't know, with the goal of converting them to Christianity. And I said, I'm not going to do that. I'm like, I don't know this person from Adam. I'm not going to try to get them to become a Christian. I'm a big believer that if you become a Christian, you're giving up your life. You're signing your death notice. I'm a big believer in that your faith should kill you, whether it's through martyrdom or a green martyrdom, where you give your life so much over to Christ that it's no longer you that lives, but Christ. And I told them, I'm not going to ask that of somebody that I can't journey beside. You know, I'm not going to ask somebody to give up their life if I can't be there with them and help them. I think that'd be cruel and unusual. And so they got mad at me for that. And there was another issue, which in a lot of ways we're struggling with this still today, around the topic of LGBTQ inclusion and what that looks like and where we as a church should be or need to be, or where we're at, what's right, what's wrong, where those lines are. And we had a conversation about that, and I don't believe that I said anything out of line, anything that was outside of where the Church of the Nazarene stands, but I was looked dead in the face by the person and said, it's a good thing that I'm not the one that's in charge of your ordination. You would never be ordained in the Church of the Nazarene under me. And that was the last time I stepped foot in that church. And it got to the point where, you know, I know you've been talking about deconstruction on your podcast, and for me, that really was a period of deconstruction that summer. I had been deconstructing throughout all of college. You know, I tell people college was a sledgehammer breaking down the brick wall of who I was and my beliefs. And seminary taught me the skills of how to rebuild that wall and what I need to include and what I could throw away and what was a firm foundation and what wasn't. But that summer, it came to the point where I had never not loved God or never not loved Christ, but if the evangelical church that I grew up in was all there was, it wasn't worth it. It wasn't a story worth dying for. Jeremy Scott, at the end of that semester, Jeff Barker had introduced me to him and said, hey, I think this might be a good place for you next year, just to kind of learn and serve and grow beside and just to experience something different than what you had known. And that was where he introduced me to the liturgy. It introduced me to the larger world of Christian history and to the saints and to those that have come before us. And that that was a story that I could sink my teeth into. That was a story that I found beautiful enough that yeah, I'm willing to give my life for that story. And I say evangelical in a very loaded sense, and I understand that. But I think a lot of what the evangelical church has done has really bastardized the gospel and made it almost unrecognizable to what it is. And so finding a way of worship that wasn't just about how I felt at the end of the service or how excited people got, but rather, what are we bringing to God? What are we offering back to God? How are we doing this divine dance or this partnership together? Was just a much more convincing story to me, a story that's been going on for 2,000 years rather than the last 100, 150 years. North Street Community Church of the Nazarene really saved my faith. Not so much my faith in Christ, but my faith in the church.
Oh, yeah. I mean, once you, and I think it's part of the evangelical story is that we've almost switched it around where we worship the church instead of Jesus. And so then when the church fails you, it causes the rest of your faith to unravel, especially your Christology to unravel. And so, yeah, you really have to rebuild your Christology and then build your church theology around Christ. I'm not sure which came first, because I know you wrote a book or you edited a book, a bunch of ancient prayers together, but then you also became a Benedictine monk. Did those two things work together, or were they completely separate things that were woven into your story, or how did that happen?
For the most part, they were two separate things, but the connecting piece that, you know, I am who I am, and so these things don't necessarily surprise people that know me very well. And so I'll start on the Benedictine part, and then I'll talk about the book a little bit. And so with becoming a Benedictine monk, I throughout seminary, that was when I became more exposed to it. I learned a little bit about it in college, and throughout seminary, just really fell in love with the idea of these intentional rhythms that were shaping people into Christ-like people, into saints of the church, into people that prayed well and lived well and served well and really embraced what it meant to be in community with one another. And I remember one night at the house I was living in seminary, praying and essentially saying, God, you're either going to get me married or make me a monk. Like these are the two options at this point. And shortly later, I started dating Annie, who is now my wife. But during that time as well, I'd struggled because I love the Church of the Nazarene for all of her flaws and faults and bumps and bruises. You know, she's my mother and she raised me, and I owe so much to her. That I struggled when I was like, okay, but if I were to become a monk, I wouldn't be able to stay Nazarene. And I didn't want to join the Catholic Church as much as I have respect for them. And I think they do a lot of things right. I think they do a lot of things wrong as well, though. And I knew that that wasn't the place that I was called to. And so struggling that even when dating Annie, I still felt this desire to somehow be in a monastic community more than just through oblation or being an oblate and just kind of being attached just roughly. And so I discovered that there was an Anglican community called Holy Cross Community, which is in, I believe it's in upstate New York, a group of Anglican monks. And that just kind of opened the wider world of discovering there's all sorts of Anglican monks and nuns. And then from there, discovering that there's also monks and nuns and friars and in the Lutheran church and even in the Methodist church, and thinking, oh, well, if there's in the Methodist church, there are sisters, there's gotta be something here. So I had a couple years ago looked at starting a monastic order, and there was about six of us that had committed to it for a while and tried to live it out. But we discovered that with none of us really knowing what we were doing per se, it was kind of hard to keep that going. And so as I worked on my dissertation, and so my doctoral dissertation is about a monastic theology within the Church of the Nazarene, and what might be possible there. As I worked on that, I became friends with several people in the House of Anishinaabe, which was a dispersed Benedictine community, made up of monks and nuns from all around the world, that gathered virtually and then in person every so often. And in conversation with Abbot Michael John and Bishop Michael, I talked about my desire to be formed and shaped in that way. And so the bishop had asked me a few questions, as well as the abbot, and eventually they decided that I was Anglican enough that as a Nazarene I could become an Anglican Benedictine. And so I had told my district superintendent about it, and we had talked about what that meant, and there was a lot of questions, as there was a lot of confusion, as could be expected from all sorts of things and about what that meant. But after explaining it to him, he was okay with it. And so I became a postulant. I took on a new name, Brother Albert Bede. And I was with that community for a year and a half, 2 years. I'd become a novice in it. And my formation master, Brother Cuthbert, he was actually really saddened when I told him that I would be leaving the community. And part of that decision came from being called to the Church of the Nazarene and not wanting to be a stumbling block to people that would not understand what I was doing. And so, and even my district superintendent, he had, when I told him, he had emailed me and shocked me by saying that he was kind of sad to learn that I was leaving that community, as he thought it was really cool. But it was recognizing that I was trying to go too far upstream from where the denomination currently is, that it was causing more confusion to people than it was good, as good as it was for me. I'm still figuring out what that monastic calling looks like today. Even now, there's a group that Jason Rowinski, and John Majesse and a few others have been working on. I don't know how much that's out there yet, but it's a group that they've been working on that I've been in conversations with them about, what can I do to be of service. And there was no ill will towards the House of Anishinaabe. Wonderful community, wonderful group of monks and nuns that I still dearly love and I still try to keep in contact with. But just recognizing that at this time, it was too much having my feet in two different worlds, and it being difficult for others to understand. But with that, with my love of monastic tendencies and the liturgy and church history, I came to love using a prayer book. Started out with Phyllis Tickle's The Divine Hours, and then I used the Book of Common Prayer for some time, and then Benedictine Daily Office. And when I was with the House of Anishinaabe, I used their prayer book, The Work of God, and just really falling in love with being able to pray prayers that weren't necessarily my own words, but words that became mine. Being able to pray for more than just what spontaneously pops up in me. I tell people all the time, like I'm not a really good prayer. When I go to bed at night, my prayers tend to be the same things, and really they're probably pretty boring. But being able to pray the words of others and let them become my words have been really beneficial. There'd be times when one of the prayer books would call you to pray for your local government leaders. And there are several times where I'm like, I don't even know who my mayor is, or I don't know who the governor of the state is. And so having to look at who that is to then pray for that person. I don't have kids, so I would have never thought to pray about the local elementary school right down the road. But praying for your community, like having these prompts, just made me a person that could pray better, and to be shaped by a larger story that goes beyond just my own page in this great book of faith. And so the Book of Ancient Prayers, how that came about was working with a plain account. We had put out a couple devotionals for the last couple Lenten and Advent seasons. And one of the things that I contributed to those was each week including a prayer from a saint or somebody from the church, just to help others as they're going through the week or their prayers, just to kind of have that as a foundation to work on throughout the week and to build their own prayers off of. And Danny Quamstrom, the president of a plan account, his wife Kayla had said to him, you know, it'd be really cool if there was like just a book of prayers like this that would be easily accessible. She's like, do you know of any? And he said, well, I know somebody that could probably write that. And so Danny had called me and said, I've got a book for you. I was like, oh, well, thanks. And he's like, okay, I want you to write a book of ancient prayers. And it was either a really good decision or a really dumb decision that I said yes to working on it while working on my dissertation. And so when I got tired of researching prayers and reading them, I would work on my dissertation. And when I got tired of writing my dissertation, I would go back to the prayer book. Through working on the two of them, I was telling my editor for my current book, I was saying, between working on the two of them, I think I got them done faster than I would have working on just one of them. So yeah, it was a lot of fun just utilizing different resources I knew and different prayers that I were familiar with, looking up different prayer books and faith books from different countries and throughout the centuries. And so it was really fun. And the title's a little misleading with it saying the Book of Ancient Prayers, because not all of the book or not all of the prayers are ancient. It goes back to the earliest known prayer or the earliest Christian prayer outside of the scriptures from Saint Clementine. And then the most recent one was from Father Michael Judge, who died on 9/11. And so while he's not necessarily ancient, nor is his prayer, I believe that that prayer will continue to live on in the lives of people for years and years to come. And when people look back in the year 8,000 and think of 9/11 as the early church and the early Christians, that his prayer will still echo throughout the centuries.
I don't want to think about what the world will be like in the year 8,000.
Yeah, Brian Zahn has often mentioned, he's like, for all we know, we still are the early church. And so that just plays in my mind a lot of what is the legacy that we are leaving for the church to come? And what is the witness that they will look back on when they see us as potentially still the early church?
What an interesting concept, especially since our Reformed and even more so our fundamentalist brothers and sisters would say, no, these are the last days, like Christ is returning any minute. Of course, I've been hearing that since I became a Christian in 1992. But and then for us to flip it on its head and say, no, we're actually the early church. Yeah, it does make you have to rethink some things. Like, yeah, I'm gonna have to think about that for a while. I like that. It's fresh. It's fresh rather than just trying to prove that some of our fundamentalist theology is nonsense, but just flipping it on its head and looking at it as ourselves as the early church. Anyway, I really like that. For people who are really starting this deconstruction, or maybe they're right in the middle of it all, do you have any advice or encouragement? Like, how can they use some of this more ancient, the ancient forms of worship and the ancient disciplines to help them as they process some of this stuff?
I think most of the people that I know that have deconstructed or are deconstructing are not doing it out of a lack of faith or out of a lack of love. That they still love God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, that they are so encaptured by the story of Christ that it's hard to believe when they see the way that the church is doing things around them. I don't really know anybody, at least in my circles of friends, that have deconstructed because they're just tired of Jesus. You know, I think Jesus is such a beautiful story, is such a beautiful life, that it's it's hard to be tired of Jesus, but looking at the ways people who have claimed to follow him have acted or done things, I can easily understand why people say, like, well, I just can't believe that. As a chaplain, you know, not everybody wants to see a chaplain because they have preconceived notions of what I do. I've had people talk to me and say, well, I just can't believe in that God that you believe in. Well, tell me about the God you don't believe in. And the God they believe in sound like an absolute jerk. And I'm like, I don't believe in that God either. And so for those going through deconstruction, you know, what I often try to remind people of is we all have to have some foundation that we're building our life upon. We're meant for community. And so deconstructing is good, but we need to be willing to reconstruct as well. We need to look at what our embedded theology is, what has been given to us, and we have to also develop a deliberate theology where we discover what's really important, what do I really believe, why do I believe this. And so for those that are deconstructing, to take time to ask those questions, to find safe people to walk with and to ask questions to people that will let you experience your emotions with God. I often think that one of my core emotions, so if we're looking at like the movie Inside Out and the way that, you know, she's controlled by joy is kind of her primary emotion. I often think for me, the guy sitting at the main desk is probably anger. Even though I don't think I come across as an angry person, there's a lot of anger that drives what I do. Anger at injustice, anger at things not being where they should be, anger at times with God. And having those friends who have let me express words of anger towards God and not saying things like, oh, you shouldn't do that, but saying, yeah, God's big enough to handle your crap. Like, it's not really going to bother him if you're screaming at him. You know, God's cool with it. Get it out. Let's figure out what's beneath that anger. And so, yeah, with those that are deconstructing, you know, finding safe people that won't wound you in your process of deconstructing. Because I think, again, I think the people that walk away completely from the faith, it's not because of the story of Christ, but it's because of the church around them. What I try to remember is my little corner of the church is not all there is. Is not all there is in history. We're not going to be all there is. That the church will continue to grow and evolve and change, and as anybody does, it'll continue to grow up, and it might lose parts of itself, it might gain different parts. And so finding ways of being faithful to Christ and keeping yourself rooted in that story, even during deconstruction. You know, what I've often told some pastors that I know who get so upset when people are in the process of deconstructing, I often remind them, at least to me, the narrative that I see is they so love this story that they can't let it be what they're seeing, that there has to be more to this story than what's been offered to them. You know, one of the areas that I've had to grow in and change my own theology is my theology of hell. The theology I had of hell as a little kid is very different than the way I think of hell now. And it's upset some pastors when I've talked about it. I had one pastor ask me when I was talking about, I was going to preach on hell and some of my views and theologies about it. And she said, well, then why would anybody be a Christian if that's true? And I just had to look at her and I said, I don't think you know the story of Christ well enough if you're asking that question. I don't know. People have made deconstruction out to be a bad word or a bad thing. But if you've been given a house that has a crumbling foundation or the walls are collapsing, the safest thing to do is deconstruct so that you can then reconstruct it, so that you can make it a house worth living in. Again, to those that are deconstructing, do it well and do it safe and do it with people that can help you and guide you and be there for you. And to those that fear it, It's better to have a reconstructed safe house than a house that's going to collapse and then kill us.
Okay, so on the flip side, I do have a chunk of people who are listening who are either exploring or they're just starting the process to answer the call to ministry. So this is an opportunity. If you knew then what you know now, what advice would you give yourself?
That's such a hard question. Annie was the after I got ordained, she had told me how happy she was because it's a lot harder to get in trouble once you're ordained. You know, it's a lot easier for them to deny your ordination than to defrock you. Although that even that's coming into question in our denomination nowadays. But what I would say to those that are going through the ministerial process of becoming a pastor or a minister in the Church of the Nazarene is to be honest about your questions or your concerns or your doubts. Those aren't a bad thing. It can be hard because some people on our credentialing boards see those as bad things. But I think if you can be gracious in naming where you're truly at, I think most people are willing to work with that. You know, for me, one of the things that if I could go back and give myself advice, I would probably tell myself to be a little less arrogant. You know, my mom, when I was a little kid, used to tell me all the time, Brent, the issue isn't that you're smart. The issue is that you know you're smart. And so you let yourself get in trouble. Because I had fun when I was a teenager making adults run around as I was arguing apologetics with them. And there's a time and a place for that, but for those that are becoming a minister in the denomination, being willing to name where you're actually at with a number of things, knowing that that may or may not be a hindrance. I think it's more faithful and more not as damaging to one's soul. I know a lot of people that have been told to lie through the credentialing process, and I don't think it's worth it because then there's headaches afterwards, you know. And one of the areas that I've been kicking around a lot lately is the idea that, and Pete Enns in one of his books talks a lot about this, is that doubt is not contrary to faith. Doubt is not a bad thing. To have questions and concerns and to not be, yes, this is exactly correct, is not a bad thing. You know, the opposite of faith is certainty. There's no need for faith with absolute certainty. If I know that this bridge isn't going to collapse, yeah, I don't need faith to cross it. And I think this is a very dangerous thing with where we are right now in our denomination. But when they ask you questions about X, Y, or Z, to say, I don't know where I stand on this yet. I'm not sure if I agree with this. I know when they talk to me about the idea of hell, and I would say, I don't think the way we talk about it is the best. But I'm not going to cause a fuss over it, if that makes sense as well. You know, I'll work to educate and change people's mind. I'm not going to do damage to our witness because I disagree with this. You know, and even right now, I'm thinking there's one topic that's a pretty divisive topic that people may or may not agree with the denomination stance on. And being able to, and that tends to be the hot button question, at least on my district, for people going through the credentialing process. Just be honest with where you're at and willing to, if you disagree, are we willing to work well within our disagreements? Or if we do agree, are we willing to be gracious to those that disagree? So a really long answer made short, I would say just be gracious, be faithful and be gracious. And as much as I love the Church of the Nazarene, she's not all there is. There's so many ways to be faithful that being an ordained minister in the Church of the Nazarene might not be the most faithful thing for a person to be, which I'm sure some people won't like me saying as an ordained minister within the Church of the Nazarene. And I don't want to dissuade anybody. I think we need good pastors in our denomination. Don't ruin your soul for the sake of a title.
Amen. Oh, that's good stuff. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast.